the coin machine.
Okay, so I have a pile of problem sets here. You can pick up yours after class if you want. This pile will end up in a box outside my office door, which you can pick them up at your convenience there.
The grades for problem sets 1 and 2 should be posted on Blackboard already. Let's see, exam 1 is a week from Tuesday. It will be here during lecture time. Old exams are on the web. Again, as I mentioned, you can write anything you want on 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper. Here, if you put in formulas, examples, small prayers, that's what you would like to have. You can write every integral known to man. That's fine with me. Whatever. It's anything that makes you feel good. One side of the sheet.
Couple of comments. One, when I say one sheet or one side of one sheet, that means no topological enhancements.
That may seem like an absurd thing for me to say. I can assure you that I have come to an exam and looked at a formula sheet that was a sheet with about 30 note cards taped to it so that they could be flip cards. Seriously, if I see topological enhancements, I will just take the sheet and rip it up.
I don't know to what extent you're used to that type of thing
in a physics class. If indeed you're actually concerned about what you have on that sheet for the most part, you're probably not studying right. It's not about how much of the book you can condense on that student sheet, right? That sheet really should just be there to jog your memory for a few little things where when you're doing problems, you find you always need to look them up. So if you always forget that arc length is equal to r theta because you have a little glitch in your mind, and I'm very familiar with such glitches, then write s equals r theta on your formula sheet. Okay? I will also supply some of that stuff because I have such glitches, so I'll have a formula sheet where most anything I can think of you probably would need would be on there. Because this, you, I hope you notice, it's not really about memorizing formulas. It's about knowing what to do with it. So if you find yourself at the copy machine shrinking so that you can put copies of the text on the sheet, you probably need to go buy the espresso or tequila or something, catch a grip, and come back and go look and make sure you understand the problems. Yeah.
Do we, in 143, we have to do a lot of ballpark by hand calculations? Do we have to do that here too, or will everything be in variables or very basic simplifications?
Could be either. Certainly variables for the most part. I mean, if you're uncomfortable with variables, you just got to get over that now. If I'm asking for a number, I'll give you the constants or you can ask for it. By no means do I expect you to memorize the electron charge or D or K in terms of the number. That's just not important to me. Anything else? Yes.
So do we need a calculator for the exam?
Do you need a calculator for the exam? Bring a calculator. I have no idea until I make out the exams whether you'll need it or not. Yes, sometimes I do ask you to actually calculate. One of the things that you may notice, I probably do it a little less in this class because it's a bit more people who might be interested in being physicists or something that's very physics-oriented. But I do try to mix up the styles of problems. So sometimes I may have something that's very much variables, and then I may have something that actually asks you to calculate a number. And I may even give you some multiple choice conceptual or short essay problem, a little brief answer. And one of the reasons I do that is I'm literally trying to do things where different people may have their different comfort zones, for what it's worth. So they all sort of hit different people differently. So the probability is you will see something that's very much variable heavy, and you may see something that's very much give me a number sort of thing. That said, when you're doing the problems, especially even if it's a give me the number sort of thing, what's really important is that you make very clear what you're thinking, how you set it up, what it is you're calculating. That way, if you screw up a numerical calculation, or you drop the sign, or you do something like that, then you're not likely to lose that many points. If the sign is very important because you have the direction wrong for some sort of conceptual thing, that's what we're testing for, yeah, you'll get creamed for that. But if you're just doing algebraic error, you know, you'll lose a point or two, but you're not going to get hammered. Yes.
Or you can get this week's homework back before.
That's right. Oh, this week?
Yeah.
We'll try. I mean, if it's really important for you to have your written homework, you ought to just make copies before you hand it in, because depending on how busy the TAs are and stuff, they may not get it back right away. Anything else?
Okay, the last thing is I need to tell you specifically what's on the exam, and you can assume that most of the stuff that we will cover, well, the dividing point will either be sometime today or sometime Tuesday's lecture. I have to have to think. So mostly there'll be things that you've had a chance to cover both in workshop and problem sets. And so I have to actually sit down and look at what I'm giving you for next week's problem set to decide exactly what the dividing point is. And when I do, I'll send you an email that has specific information of exams up through the booth. Okay? And I'll try to do that in the next couple of days. All right, so last time we were talking about potential. So conceptually, potential is, it is how much work per unit charge it takes to do something. That would be a potential difference. You can define an absolute potential if you've defined a zero somewhere and you are asking how much work does it take relative to that to make this charge distribution. So what is commonly done, particularly for things where a point charge is relevant or the charge is confined in some area of space, if you're not given an absolute potential in the context of that region of space, then usually you want to think of the potential at infinity being zero. And so if you do that for a point charge and you ask how much work does it work per unit charge it takes to move it from infinity to some point, which is at a radius r away from simple point charge q, you find it's kq over r. Okay? And as you know, with Gauss's law, I have a spherical charge distribution. And I go outside of it, I know that the electric field looks just like it does from a point charge. So even if I have a sort of a distributed charge distribution, this would be the potential at a point radius, the radius r, if you're outside of that. If you have multiple discrete charges, then you just sum up the potentials, and it's an algebraic sum. So it's a lot easier than electric field or forces, because you don't have to worry about direction. And then if you have a continuous charge distribution, the way to think about it is, let me define a little tiny piece of that charge, consider it as a point charge, write down the potential due to that point charge at some point P, which would be K dQ, because it's now a little differential charge, over R. And now you sum up over all the little dQs, which is what you mean when you say M. Okay, and that would give you the potential at point P. Whether this is easy or hard depends entirely on the actual geometry that you're handed. Sometimes it's impossible, and sometimes it's not bad at all. Usually dq can be written in terms of a rho dv, where rho is some function that basically defines how hard it is going to be to do that problem. Okay, any questions conceptually on what that is? So what this is saying is, if I have this charge distribution sitting there, if I were to bring a charge in from infinity and put it at this point, how much work would that per unit charge would that take? And that would be the absolute potential at that point. Okay? So potential differences are very well defined, because you don't have to worry about how zero is defined. It's just the work per unit charge it takes to go from one point to another. It depends only on the endpoints and the physical situation. It doesn't matter how the path works, because electromagnetism is a conservative force. All right? There is no friction moving the charge from one point to another, so you're losing energy to something else. Okay, so one of the reasons why potential is a very good thing to figure out is that potential is often relatively easy to figure out, because it does not involve directions. The minute you put in directions, you have to do vectors, and things get a little bit nastier. So very often, if you're thinking about the energy in a system, you can sort of figure out what the potential function or the potential field is. That is, how does this potential energy vary as a function of three states? And you can determine the electric field from that. As you might imagine, there's a deep relationship between potential and electric field. Potential has to do with how much work it takes to go from one place to another. The force that is on the charge as you move it from one place to another is due to the electric field. So there's going to be this relationship between how you move and what is the electric field. So if we put it in, if we sort of flip that around and we ask, let me look at the electric field, if I know the potential, it turns out to be relatively simple. You simply take, if you want to know the electric field component in a given direction, so I'll say some generalized coordinate S, I just take the minus the derivative of the potential function in that coordinate. All right. Now, you should be so lucky as to live in a one-dimensional world. We live in a three-dimensional world, so things become a little more complicated. So we talked about last time, if we generalize this to three dimensions, we now have to allow the potential function to have a dependence in all three dimensions, and that means we have to put that dependence, the slope in each of those dimensions effectively into this. And so the way that we do that is we define something which is called the gradient. So it basically finds the component of E in the x direction by taking the derivative of the potential in the x direction and then giving it the x component. And you do that for y and z, so you basically look at this slope in each of the three directions and combine it in order. And that's what this gradient really does. These funky symbols are partial derivatives, which you need to know how to do for, because you've got the dependence on all three variables. Effectively, what they mean is a normal derivative you take of the function where you hold the constants that you're not taking you hold the variables that you're not taking the derivative with respect to constant. You treat them as constant. So what that does is, in a three space, which could be very complicated, you're looking at a certain point and looking at the slope in that direction where you're taking derivative at that point. And while you have held those other variables constant, if you evaluate the partial derivative at other points, those constants actually are different, because y and z or whatever will change as you move it around. So this is that partial derivative gives you the slope in that direction effectively at all different points in space. Yes?
E negative delta?
Yeah, would be. Thank you. Okay, so this vector operator is called del, and we will use it in other functions as well. but this is the first function where we do it, where it effectively is a multiplicative thing. Not quite multiplicative, because in the multiplication you're also including these derivatives and you're doing it by components. So it's sort of a strange beast. But so the symbol is this. You'll note there's no dot here. There's no cross there. It's just a multiplicative thing. The other thing you'll notice is that this is actually a vector. It contains three components. A little bit odd, because it's not got a magnitude per se. The magnitude of each of these components really is, take the derivative of whatever, and that becomes your magnitude. So it's a strange piece that you'll have to get used to. So this would be called the gradient of the potential, or gradient function. And it also should have a negative sign in there. Sometimes you'll see it written as grad d. Okay, same thing. And just notice that that is a scalar function, but when you take the gradient of it, you end up with a vector. So this is converting the scalar potential field into the vector field of it, the electric field. Any questions about the gradient? All right, so we've seen that if I define the zero out at infinity and I move a charge in regardless of the path and I put it at a point which is at a radius r, some charge q, then I have an absolute potential at that point, which is kq over r. And if you can imagine, if I have a circle at a radius r, then the potential at point A and the potential at point B are going to be the same, because they're at the same radius, and there's nothing in this that cares about what angle you're at. It's only what distance you're at, radius. So C here is at a different radius, but A, B, and D are all going to be at the same radius. So they all are at the same potential. So what that means is, if A and B are at the same potential, it means that regardless of the path, if I move a charge from A over to B, it takes zero work. Okay? If I go from C to D, again, regardless of the path, it will take the amount of work, which is equal to the difference of potential between D and C. So it would be KQ over RD minus KQ over RC. And it doesn't matter how I move it. I can be as obnoxious as I want to be. Okay? Depends only on the endpoints. So, one of the things you'll see, though, is that regardless of what point where I come in, if I put it at this radius, these are all at the same potential. So, we call this black circle, and anything similar to it, we call them lines of equipotential. If two charges are on the same line of equipotential, it takes no work to move it from one point to another along that line. Okay? If I move away from that line of equipotential, then by definition, I'm changing the potential, and it now takes work to go from one point to another. Right? If I have a charge and I'm moving it in some electric field, and the amount of work it takes, or the work it would take to move this charge, remember, is going to be only contribute to the integral of work if I'm moving with a component that is parallel to the electric field. So another way to say that is, if I have an electric field in space, I have an equipotential line so long as it is always at right angles to that electric field. Because then I'm always moving the charge along that line with no component up or down on the, along the field. So the E dot ds, or the force per unit charge times distance, is going to be zero. Okay? So equipotential lines you can also think of as being perpendicular to the electric field. So you in your mind should be able to go from the map of the electric field to the map of the equipotential lines, and vice versa. They basically have the same information. But one's at right angles to the other, so if I ask for one and you think the other, that doesn't work so well. Alright, so be thinking one, or, you know how to go back and forth. So if I have a point charge Q, then the equipotential lines are going to be lines at fixed radii. And you can imagine these just going out to infinity and being actual circles, not just what I drew. If I have, for example, a flat plate here and a flat plate here with a big plus charge Q here and a big minus charge Q here, and we ignore the edge effects at the edges of the plates, then if I say that the plates have uniform density, then I can say that the electric field will look like this. It's a uniform electric field. And the equipotential lines are going to look like what? They're just going to be lines at right angles here. Okay, so it takes no work. If I have a charge at a given position between the plates, if I move it at right angles to the plates, there's no work involved. But to move the other way is work. Okay? Another way to think about it is, you remember that the electric field is minus the gradient of the potential.
Gradient is a really great choice for what we're doing with the gradient. If you're on a hill and I ask you, where you're standing, what is the gradient? You would pick the direction that has the most change in height per distance. And that would be the gradient, right? If you had a marble where your feet were and you just let it go, it would roll in the direction of the gradient of whatever slope you're on. So
the electric field is in the direction of the gradient. You have a gradient if I go a little ways, I have a change in the potential or a change in the height. So the electric field, sort of by definition, has to be at right angles to changes in right angles to the lines of constant potential or lines of constant height, if you want to think about it that way. If I'm standing in an area that has constant height and I put a marble there, it goes nowhere. You have no gradient there. The gradient's zero. All right, I can tell you're bored, so we're going to do a problem. Let's suppose we have a Cartesian coordinate system, and in the xy plane we have a circle, a ring. All right, so that's supposed to be in the XY plane. Hard to visualize. And let's say that we have a point P that's out here on the x-axis somewhere. So the problem, and so we'll also say that, so we have this circular ring of charge. XY plane. Centered at the origin. Find the potential at point P and the electric field at point P. And I guess I can tell you that lambda on this ring is constant. So if we say that we have a total charge Q on the ring, then lambda is just going to be equal to Q divided by 2 pi times the radius, which we'll just define as little r. Sorry. I want to define that as A. You might think, why do I care? And the reason why I care is because I've written in my notes A, and if I use a different variable here now, later on, I won't pay attention and I'll pull out the A, and you're going to look at it and you go, what the hell is A? So, alright, so that's the problem. So then the question is, how do we do this? So the way to do this is you consider some arbitrary point charge in the distribution, which is our little dq, and that dq is going to be some radius vector r. It'll actually be a distance r, if you wish. And that will, and P will say is at position X. I won't really, we can make it an X or something, we'll just call it X. So it's at some arbitrary X. All right. So if you look at this, if the ring is centered, this distance from dq down to the origin is radius A. So I have a triangle here, which is x here and A there. And it's canted at an angle the way I've drawn it. But if I put it in the z, if I put dq right here on the z, then it's a little easier to see. It would come down and you'd have x and A up like that. So that distance is also A, and this distance I'm just calling X. So what that means is that R is equal to X squared plus A squared to the 1/2. Right? Now you've actually done this problem or something very similar where you calculated the electric field separately. Or directly. And when you do that, the way we can do that is you say, okay, I have a little dq here, and that gives me a little dp down this way. And similarly, I have a dq over here, which gives me a little de up that way. And the transverse components will cancel each other out, leaving only the component which is headed along x. That injects some sort of angular piece, a cosine or a sine. And you then have to couch that sign in terms of these variables that you want to integrate. Right. So you've done that problem, and it's doable. It is one where mere mortals can actually do them, but it's not particularly fun. So let's look at this one. Now what we want to do is potential, but we don't care about the direction. Okay? The direction is no longer important. The potential at point P is equal to the integral of k dq over the distance from dq to P, which is just r. So dq is going to be lambda dv. In this case, the volume is just this ring, so it's just going to be lambda ds, where s is an arc length around the integral. So this will be k. R is actually a constant. The integral of lambda ds around the ring. So lambda is a constant that pulls out. And we're doing the integral around the ring from 0 to 2 pi a. So this is 2 pi a times lambda times k over r. See how easy that was? No cosine thetas to worry about or anything. And now we can rewrite it in terms of the other variables. So that's k over k times lambda, but lambda is q over 2 pi a times 2 pi a over r, which is x squared plus a squared to the 1/2. The reason I want to write it that way is that I now, this is certainly valid, but it's in terms of this r, and I'm really asked what it is as a function of x. So to get it as a function of x, I have to rewrite r in terms of that. The other thing is the next step is to find the electric field, and so I now have to take derivative, and I need to take the derivative with respect to some variable, and it'll make more sense to do x instead of r, because r is changing in direction as you go, so you would have to take an infinite number of derivatives if you really wanted to do it in terms of r. But in terms of the electric field, if I have a piece here that pushes me that way, I have a piece over here that pushes me that way, the transverse components of the electric field will cancel out. So for this problem to be easy, even if I use potential, I still have to recognize that symmetry. Because the next step is to ask you, if I want to take the derivative of the potential to get the field, if you recognize the symmetry, you can see immediately you only need to worry about taking that derivative with respect to that direction.
I'm just wondering, since it doesn't matter what the direction is, because it's a scalar, can we simplify the problem by just pretending that there's a point charge at radius r from the origin, and then you would just get kq over r squared equals kq over x squared plus a squared? Because it's not like it matters at all.
We will look at this exact solution, and then what we'll do is go far away. And when you go far away, it will have to simplify to exactly that. But it is not the field of the point charge as you get close to it, because it's a ring, it's not a point charge.
Sorry, I mean not the field, the potential. The potential should be the same.
The potential on the on the axis, you can think of it that way.
All right.
I have to think for just a moment. Certainly, if you're in the center of it, it looks just like the field of the point charge. The potential of the point charge. It's sort of odd. It's got a point charge here, the potential looks like that. I have a ring of charge, and I put the point in the middle, it also has the same potential. It's sort of interesting. If you're now moving farther away along the axis, what's relevant is the distance you are from the ring, which isn't exactly the distance from the axis. So there is a little difference there. That difference becomes small as you move far away.
Well, I was just saying more like, instead of like you have a ring, so you have a bunch of dq these that are all at a distance, x squared plus a squared to the 1/2. So if you were to pretend that you took all of that charge and you just like took it away from these edges and put it all at the top, you wouldn't have to deal with worrying about the circle.
Right. No, that's true. That's true. I think that works.
All right, so this is the potential to confirm that you think you're right. Let's say that we go to large X. So if I go to large X, this ring no longer looks like a ring. It looks like just a point charge or total charge Q because I'm very, very far away. So if I look at this at large X, this X is much larger than A. So you ignore A. This becomes X squared to 1/2. So that's just X. So this is KQ over X. X is the distance you are away. So it's KQ over R. So that's exactly the point charge potential, which is what you want to see. That's good. All right, so to find the electric field at point P, that's minus the gradient of the potential. You can do this a couple different ways. One was sort of looking at the symmetry and realizing that the electric field has only an x component, so I'm only going to worry about taking the derivative of this function of x. More formally, you can also just look at it and say there is only an x dependence here, so the partial derivative with respect to y is 0 and the partial derivative with respect to z is 0, so you don't actually even have to recognize the symmetry. Mathematics tells you what it is. So it is
equal to minus the derivative, actually it's an actual derivative, not a partial derivative. And that's equal to KQX over A squared plus X squared to the 3/2. And this will be in the X hat direction. Okay, so that's what you get when you take the derivative. And then you can ask yourselves, do I believe that? How would you decide whether you believe that or not?
You're missing the negatives.
You sure about that? When I take the derivative of 1/2 is a minus 1/2, so it comes down, I think you get rid of minus. I also know that the electric field better be pointed in the positive x direction. That's a problem. So you can look at units, but you also can do the limiting cases. So limiting cases is now if you let x become large,
you do the limit, you find that E will go to KQ over x squared in the x hat direction. So you, which is what you would expect for a point charge Q.
So these limiting cases are very, very useful, okay, very often, because regardless of what kind of weird structure I have here, if I know the total charge and I go very, very far away, I no longer can resolve the structure. All I see, I will only see it as effectively a point charge. So I should know what it looks like. Any questions?
So this is an example, I think, of one where it's easier to calculate the field going through the potential than it is the other way around. It is not always obvious. So
like I say, you want to make sure that you systematically look at the types of problems that are done for field calculations and potential calculations, just in terms of test taking and test preparations. Very often, if you look at certain geometries and things, you'll see that some of them are better done one way than the other. I don't have a really great rule of thumb to tell you, short of systematically going through and recognizing different geometries. You'll typically see those types of problems. And if you do them the other way, you may find out why they are normally done the way that they are. So. Okay, let us change course a little bit. Let's suppose I have an infinite sheet of charge. Let's say it's positive charge. So I have that positive charge basically distributed all over that sheet. So if I have that, let's say that I have a uniform surface charge density, sigma. Okay? So by the symmetry of this problem, the electric field is going to be pointing away from the sheet. Because if I put a charge over here, it's going to be moving to the right. If I put a test charge to the left, it's going to go to the left. By symmetry, there can be no up and down components because I have an infinite sheet with a constant field. So by the symmetry argument, I know that E is going to look like so. And sigma has units of coulombs per meter squared because it's an area charge. So then the question is, what is the electric field as a function of distance from the sheet? Any questions about what I'm asking? Infinite sheet of charge, and I just simply want to know, what is the electric field out here, or here, or there, or here? Okay. So, what I want to do is to draw a Gaussian surface. For simplicity, I will put the end caps at some distance here, which I can call D if you want. And also for simplicity, let's say that this looks like a bit of a pillbox. So if we look at a little bit from an angle, here's the sheet of charge. And we're going to say that my Gaussian surface looks something like that. So it's like a pipe that you bisect with the sheet of charge. Okay, so And just for simplicity, we'll say that each surface of this Gaussian surface, I'm sorry, the end caps, have area A. So now, if we look at Gauss's law, the electric field is going at right angles to this surface, so it's out like this. So the contribution to Gaussian, to the left-hand integral for Gaussian law, from the pipe piece, the sides, E dot dA is zero. So there's no contribution there. So I only need worry about the end caps. The end caps have area A. I have a uniform electric field moving through at right angles. So E dot dA becomes E times A. I have one over here and one over here. The field is going outward both ways. So it's 2 times E times A. So I have 2 times E times A on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, it is the amount of charge that is enclosed in the Gaussian surface, which is going to be A times sigma. Sigma is the charge per unit area. And the pipe subtends, the pipe cuts out a hole of area A on the surface. So this is equal to sigma times A over epsilon naught. So the electric field at some distance d, you'll note that d didn't come into this. It's just sigma over 2 epsilon naught. Does anything bother you about that?
What bothers you? It should get weaker if you get farther away. It sort of seems like it ought to, huh? I could be a million miles away, and that electric field is still sigma over 2 epsilon naught. Does that bother you?
It does a little. Okay, why should it not really bother you? What do you think?
It's supposed to just be as an infinite plate.
Okay, so it really ought not bother you because we start out with the crazy problem. If I have an infinite sheet of charge, why can't you have some infinite energy in the field or have a field that goes off to infinity? Okay, so it's a little nonsensical from the start. Okay? If I shrink it down so it's not an infinite sheet, for a Gaussian surface that is very, very close to it, it looks like an infinite sheet. The symmetry more or less still holds. So this gives you the field close to a flat sheet of charge. The way that I get around this weird infinity, or the field that stays constant out forever, is if this has a finite area, I can go far enough away that eventually it has to look like a point charge. So things have to change when I go down. Okay. So although this may, in a sense, seem like conceptual crap, it's very useful. Because if I have charge distributed on a sheet, if I get close enough to that surface, even if it is a crinkled potato thing, if I get close enough to that surface, it's going to look flat. Okay? If you don't believe me, think of yourself as a gnat on it. And then if that doesn't work, think of yourself as something much smaller. So it's a lot like us being on the surface of the earth. Okay? It sort of looks flat to us, even though it's not. So that makes it very useful, in a sense, because this gives you a sense of sort of what the field needs to look like near the surface of something that has a charge distribution on it, if it's sort of even in that sort of near differential of charge, so it doesn't look like it's changing. Okay, but you have to pay attention, because if it's important to see how things change, then you can't make that approximation, because then it just looks like an infinite sheet of charge. So, but it does give you a sense of what might be happening in cases. But a little bit of this is, you will also run into infinities
where they're sort of there by construction. So we have this electric field that goes off to infinity at full strength. But that's a product of how we define the problem, which is a little unpredictable to begin with. So if you get something that seems really wacky, go and look at how you really set it up. And it may be that what you get makes sense for the wackiness of the problem.
Okay. Here's our infinite sheet. And with this infinite sheet, we know that we have electric field lines that go like so. I'm going to move it out this way a little bit. If I take this and I have the same thing, but I have negative charge, I'm going to make it pink. Then I have the same thing, except the electric field is now going in toward the sheet. Same arguments apply, so it'll have the same magnitude as the one for the positive sheet of charge that we just set up. If we say that we sigma is the same, so here we have a plus sigma, and here we have a minus sigma. So now I have exactly what I just set up for you. Now what I want to do is to take that negative sheet and I want to move it so that it is parallel to the first sheet. Remember that the electric field is a vector field. So that means if I have two electric fields in some region of space, they're both there independently. And I find the end result by superimposing them vectorially. So if we ask, what in the world have I created here when I overlap these two things, you have to imagine that this green electric field is still there. And the pink electric field is still there, regardless of the fact that you have that other sheet over there. Okay? And now you vectorially superimpose these fields. And by construction, these have the same sigmas. This one has an electric field that is two sigma over epsilon naught that way and that way. This one has an electric field that is two sigma over epsilon naught the other direction. Okay? So notice that here they cancel out completely. Here they cancel out completely. And in the middle, the pink one is going to the right and the green one is going to the right, so they add together. Okay? So what this ends up looking like is something like so, with an electric field just here. Out here, E is equal to zero. Out here, E is equal to zero. And the field in here, the electric field, the strength, is equal to sigma over epsilon naught. I may have misspoken a moment ago. The field out here of the green is sigma over 2 epsilon naught.
And the pink is sigma over 2 epsilon naught the other way, and they cancel out. But they add together here the mu sigma over epsilon naught. Okay? And this geometry, for obvious reasons, is something we call parallel plates. I can spell parallel. I can't. It's two R's? One R? Two L's?
Two
L's? Whatever. You can figure it out. For reasons that we will talk about, this is incredibly useful. It's often called a parallel plate capacitor. We'll talk about capacitance maybe today. If not, then we'll do it Tuesday. The other thing you'll notice is that it gives you a very well-constrained and well-defined electric field that is finite in space, at least in one direction. So this is a system that is really useful for studying all sorts of things. So I'm actually, you might as well just know these and put it on your sheet or memorize them, but the field outside of a flat plate or the field between two infinite plates, you should just know because you're going to use it a lot. So sigma over epsilon naught. And usually you're given some information about the distance between them, perhaps. Doesn't actually matter in some ways, right? Because the field doesn't care. Plates like this, the field, because they're infinite plates, is sigma over epsilon naught. All right. So very often, one of the things you want to be considering when you are looking at parallel plates is to think about work or potential inside parallel plates. So to do that, you can imagine having a little test charge Q0 somewhere in between the plates. And it is a very well-defined thing to ask how much energy it takes to move that Q from one of the plates to the other plate. So notice that this plate has its positive charge on it, and this plate has its negative charge on it. So I could ask, for example, how much work it takes per unit charge for me to move the charge, the test charge Q0, from this plate over to that plate. And that would correspond to the potential difference between the two plates. So the potential difference between the plates is equal to minus the integral of E dot ds. Potential is work per unit charge. The force is charge times E. So those charges cancel. So the potential is minus E dot ds. If I'm moving directly from one plate to the other, E dot ds becomes E times ds, which is just E times d, the distance. So the potential difference between the plates is just the magnitude of that electric field times the distance. And the magnitude of the electric field, I know, is this sigma over epsilon. So the absolute value of the potential difference is equal to sigma over epsilon naught times d. Note that the potential difference does actually care how far apart the plates are. If the field is constant throughout, if I move this plate further over, it takes more work, Q times E, for me to move it from one plate to the other. So potential difference does care. Okay, even though the field is constant. All right, so as a little bit of an aside, if we were to let the absolute potential between these two plates be 1 volt, and remember that a volt is, that'd be 1 joule per coulomb. And if we were to, say, take an electron and put it right at the negative sheet and then let it go, it's now going to have a force on it, which will be constant because the electric field is constant, in the direction toward the other sheet. So it will have a constant acceleration. And at the, when it finally hits the positive sheet over here, it will have whatever, it will have a kinetic energy. So, because of this constant acceleration. So, at that point, this electron has a kinetic energy. So you could calculate that kinetic energy in joules easily enough. But what we do is we'll define it as a new unit, which we call the electron volt. Or 1 eV. So 1 electron volt is equal to 1 times the charge of the electron times 1 volt. And that's equal to 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs times 1 volt. And this, of course, is joules. So 1 eV is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules. And the reason we worry about eV is because in the real world of new electrical things or accelerating particles or things, you're dealing with batteries or power supplies and actual electrons or protons or gold ions or something. And joules just are crazy unit to be using. Way too much. So the world is much simpler if you sort of work in a world of knowing voltages and taking sort of this charge out and just using E instead of this 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joule coulombs. So the unit of EV is something that you might as well get very used to. You'll see it a lot. You'll see it in other ways. In the world of small particles and everything, electron volts begins to get used a little loosely in ways that might find confusing. We're not yet, I think we do some relativity later on, but we haven't done it yet. But in relativity, you'll find if a particle is at rest, well, even if it's that E is equal to mc squared. You may have heard of that one before. E has units of electron volts, and c is a constant, the speed of light. So very often, if you want to use a convenient unit of mass for particles, you use it in terms of EV over c squared. And so it turns out, for example, the electron has a mass of 0.511 million electron volts per c squared, or MeV per c squared. just bear in mind, it is all about job security. Okay? So one of the most fabulous things that you can do in physics to help job security is you can either work in units of C equal to 1, which means you just ignore it. And at the end, you throw in whatever C's you need to make the units work out. Or you just forget to mention. So you will very, very seldom ever hear one of the particle physicists over there talking about the top mass of 185 GeV per cc, or whatever. Or a proton mass of 938 MeV per cc, or electron mass of 0.51 MeV per cc. What we'll say is the electron has a mass of 0.51 MeV. And you should be thinking, mass, but you gave me units of energy. Very confusing. Okay? So the C square is just sort of understood. So just bear that in mind and remember it. Momenta turns out to be in MeV per C. So again, you ignore the C. So you can have an electron that has a mass of 0.511 MeV or has momentum of point, you know, and it's just you ignore the C's until you sort of need them. But the minute you want to calculate something, you better put in the C's properly, because otherwise, you know, it's not far back. Okay? All right. Imagine that I have some charge plus Q here, and let's say that pretty far away, I have a charge over here which has a minus Q, same magnitude. Let's say that they each have radius R, so they're sort of a spherical distribution. Then if I say that the minus Q is sort of far away, I can basically say how much work per unit charge does it take for me to bring a charge in from infinity and put it on the surface that has this plus Q on it. And I'll call that a V plus. And I know that that'll be K times Q over R. So the amount of work per unit charge it takes to do that is proportional to the Q. If I ask the same thing way over here to the other charge, the amount of work it takes to put a charge on that negative surface is equal to minus KQ over R. And again, this potential is proportional to the charge. We now ask, what is the potential difference between these two spheres? Then that can be the potential at the surface of one minus the potential at the surface of the other. And that is going to be 2 times K times Q over R. And what you'll notice is that this is also proportional to the charge. So it turns out this is sort of a general thing. The potential difference between these is going to be proportional to the amount of charge. There is this thing here that depends on what the system is. Am I thinking about one sphere? Am I thinking about this sphere? Am I thinking about sort of the combination of the spheres? And so there's a factor that takes into account the geometry. But this leads to a concept of something a little bit strange. So what we find is that the potential of a system is proportional to the charge.
And we call the quantity, there's a constant of proportionality which we call the capacitance. And that depends only on the geometry. So in the example up above, Q plus is equal to C plus times V plus. Unit of capacitance is, I mean, you call it C, it has units of farads. So if we just consider the positive charge, then we say that that holds true where C plus is a proportionality constant. In the case of that particular spherical charge, that's all that's there, it's K over R. We see that Q minus has a different proportionality constant, which is E minus K over R. Well, it's also K over R, actually. B. And then we have the charge is equal to this C plus minus times V plus minus if I basically think of these two charges as a system. So if I basically ask how much work does it take to assemble charge plus Q here and minus Q here, then you end up with this C plus minus. So in general, we say that Q is equal to C times V. And this capacitance, this constant that we call capacitance, will depend on the geometry. So maybe a way to think about that is consider I have two parallel plates where I put some positive charge here and minus charge here. It's going to take a certain amount of work to take this positive charge and this minus charge all from infinity and sort of put them close together. Okay? If I take this same geometry, but I now take the parallel plates and I turn them into a spiral, or maybe another way to think about it is if I have this geometry, if I bring a charge in from infinity and put it on one of these things, it takes a certain amount of work. If I have this geometry, it's going to take a different amount of work because you can sort of think of it as the field out at infinity is going to be different. If these are finite sheets, for example, then the field... Well, in both cases, it'll actually look zero the way I've set this particular problem up. The geometries... So I think capacitance is a little bit of a fuzzy concept. It turns out not to be so fuzzy in the way that you end up using it, but conceptually it's a little bit weird compared to some of the stuff we've seen. But one of the things that I love about it is C is capacitance in farads. C is speed of light. We'll usually put it in meters per second. C is charge in coulombs. C is the calorie. We use C for heat capacity. You probably can have an equation which is C is equal to CC over C or something stupid like that. And have it make complete sense.
If you have any idea what you're looking at. So, I don't know what to say. Almost always, you can tell which C you need to be worried about by context. And in some cases, it's a big C, and in some cases, it might be a little C. So Coulomb's a big C. Speed of light is little C. But with this clarifying note, I will let you go. And have a great weekend. If you're anxious to pick up your homework, yeah, there are up here.
Hi, I sent you the email last night. So we chat in your office?
Yeah. That's fine. I'll meet you there in a few minutes.
All right.
Yeah. Those are broken down by first letter, last name.
Hey, Professor.
Yeah. Hi.
I emailed you last week on Monday right before I realized that you were going to have a phone.
Oh, did I not answer?
I didn't get one back, so I assumed I just assumed that you were busy.
I'm pretty good even when I'm busy doing triage on the table. Honest to God, I get so crap that sometimes I don't even see it, right? I mean, I get
Yeah, I know.
It's 90% of the person's spam. Sometimes real ones slip through and stuff.
Okay. I was just wondering if you could set up a time on general physics and also some rig stuff.
Yeah, sure.
I figured you'd be the person to talk to.
Absolutely. So, it looks like I'm certainly.
This is my sister, Julia.
Where are you?
Your house.
Oh, okay. Webster's cheerleaders and the airport cheerleaders are always going to the cheerleaders. Had to go to a lot of competitions where they all broke down to the awesome Webster cheerleaders and the awesome cheerleaders.
I remember that it was always hotly contested.
Very hotly contested.
I've never been to a competition.
There's some.
Yeah?
I don't know. It always was funny. I mean, I never.